It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth. It's easy to forget if you live in Anchorage or on the road system, but most of Alaska is accessible only by small planes. You remember when you take off from Lake Hood or Merrill Field and start flying out over the rivers, lakes, and mountains that spread out uninhabited almost as soon as you're aloft. Lots of us have chartered to get out for a river trip or a cabin visit, but some take it a big step farther and learn to fly or even own their own planes. For most of us, that's a fantasy to get up on a sunny morning and go anywhere. But for our guests, it is a reality they have invested in with their time, money, and expertise. And I have three guests in the studio with me, all private pilots, one an expert and also an educator of pilots. That's Rocky Capozzi, who's the director of the UAE Aviation Technology. Thanks for being with us, Rocky.
My pleasure.
And you're also a pilot, fly on your own, and I think you said a 172?
That's firm.
Yes. And Chris Hodel is a pilot who has been doing it, we figured, for two-thirds of your life.
Pretty close, 34 years.
Yeah, yeah. So people can do the math now and figure out how old you are.
There you go.
I think we're all about the same age in here. And my third guest is Bob Kaufman, who has been a pilot for a shorter period of time. I thought it might be interesting to have somebody who more recently learned to be a pilot. And Bob has been on the air before on Hometown Alaska talking about some of his outdoor adventures, swimming across Cook Inlet, swimming across Kachemak Bay, climbing McKinley, all that stuff. So thanks for being with us, Bob.
Thank you, Charles. And by the way, Chris here was who did both of those swims with me.
Oh, you also did the swims. Okay. So we could, if we get tired of talking about airplanes, we can talk about swimming, but I don't think that's probably going to happen. So, Bob, you decided like 5 years ago or so that you wanted to be a pilot. What made you want to do it?
Well, I had wanted to be a pilot for a long time, probably about 10 or 15 years. And I actually took the beginning of ground school at UAA probably 10 or 12 years ago. And I went to one class and just couldn't find the time to get into it. So I always wanted to do it. I had I tore my ACL about 5 winters ago. Mm-hmm. And instead of cross-country skiing for the rest of the winter, I thought, what am I going to do? Going to finally take advantage of this opportunity to learn how to fly.
Yeah. So what was it? I mean, was it as time consuming as you expected? Was it just take a
Well, it took a lot of time, but the smart thing I did that time is I went straight over to a pilot over on Lake Hood, Heidi Roos, and the very first thing she said, there was no ground school, nothing. She said, get in the airplane. I'm like, well, which side of the airplane do you want me to get in? She said, well, you're flying the airplane, get in the left seat. So show me how to start the engine. Told me how to taxi down the runway. So I got hooked and interested enough. So then it was then worth it to invest all the time in ground school.
So rather than starting in a classroom, you start with a thrill. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, Chris, tell us about none of you gentlemen are super avid hunters or fishermen. You're mostly into flying just for the love of flying.
For the adventure of it.
Yeah. You wake up on a sunny morning. Do you like decide then where you're going to fly and just take off?
It's as often as not, that's how it happens. You look out and you see where the weather's good and you get up and go. So, you know, we have the benefit of being able to go in any direction and over the mountains or across the water. And so that's as easy as it is someday.
So just to go for a spin, look out the window, or do you usually land somewhere and go for a hike? Or how do you use the plane for doing other things?
Well, that's the beauty of the Super Cub with the large Alaska bush wheels. I can land on beaches and tundra. And so if you can do that, you go up to Lake George area and land on a strip there and go for a hike, or go out to a beach and do some beach combing. So you really have a tremendous number of options. And I probably use a runway only to depart and leave Merrill Field, and the rest of it's sand, gravel, dirt, whatever, snow.
How much room, how big of a spot do you need to actually land and take off?
If you've got a little over 400 feet, you can pretty much, that's all it takes.
Seems like it'd make you, so you would land some spot that you've never been before. You're just flying over and say, wow, that looks interesting. Check it out.
You fly over two or three times to make sure it's landable, and you run your wheels across the surface to make sure it's solid enough and the bumps are manageable, and you
put
it
down. Tell me, what does that mean, to run your wheels?
Instead of committing to a landing, you'll often get quite low and roll your wheels along the surface, particularly of a beach or a spot of of tundra, to make sure it's smooth enough and supportive enough. So safety first. We always examine our runways are built for perfection. They're perfectly flat and they're clear of all debris, But when you're landing out on beaches and sandbars, nature throws a few twists in there and might be a bump or a wow or a log or a, you know.
So you're doing this thing where you're kind of skimming along this runway to find out how, you know, and how do you, what is your indication that, no, I don't want to land here? And it's like you feel, oh, we hit something, or?
It's mostly visual, and oftentimes we'll fly over in different directions and make sure the sun is shining on it just a particular way to illuminate whatever, you know, surface undulations might not be visible from one direction or the other. So it's mostly visual, and then when you get right down to it, it's feel, because, you know, a rock that looks small from 100 feet might look enormous when you're, you know, 5 feet above it.
So. Wow.
So I took a class at UAA, you know, where Rocky is a bush flying class. And it was really good. You know, he said, you know, the main difference between off-airport flying and flying on airports is you're choosing the landing spot. So the kind of procedure that he went through is overfly it multiple times. First, you fly it at a certain speed, and you count the number of seconds so you can estimate how long the strip is. Uh-huh. Then you look around and say, if this landing doesn't go well, you know, where am I going to walk out? You know, figure out what your out is if it doesn't work out.
So in other words, if you can't take off again.
Yeah, or something like that, yeah. And then, like Chris says, you drag your wheels, keep most of the weight on the wings, judge what the surface is, go fly over your tracks, look at them. You know, make sure they look like what you think, and then you commit to the landing.
Huh, interesting. So that's a good introduction to our third guest, Rocky Capozzi, who I think must know an awful lot about flying. He's the director of the UAA Aviation Center. And tell us about just your history as a pilot.
Well, I went to Air Force pilot training in 1975 and flew fighters off and on for the next 22 years or so, and then my last few years before I retired, I flew Beech King Airs in 1900s. And a couple of years before I retired, I said I better start learning how to fly small planes because the fun's about to end here.
Right. You probably couldn't afford to run your own fighter with however many gallons of gas that takes, right? Yeah.
And then about a year after I went to took the job at UAA, one of my senior maintenance faculty members was retiring, and he owned an airplane, and I knew he took real good care of it, so I bought it from him, and that's the plane I fly today.
Uh-huh. So you run this program that is mostly training young people to be professional pilots.
Yeah, and it's actually there's four programs. Mm-hmm. One is to train A&P mechanics. The other is to train air traffic controllers. And then we also have a program for the pilots and then also administration and management. So the piloting program, as you say, to train professional pilots, there's both an associate's degree or a bachelor's degree that the students can pursue.
Mm-hmm. But it sounds like you have classes that folks could take, one class or something? Or
yeah, absolutely. Any of the ground schools are available to the public. The flying training, you have to be a UAA degree-seeking student to take the flight training.
Now, this aviation program is real. Sounds like it's a real high point of UAA and has gotten quite a reputation around the country because you're doing something that's pretty far above what most universities are doing in this area. You've got a great facility there on Merrill Field, and you're doing some pretty advanced stuff.
Well, I think we have a very solid program. There are many fine aviation institutions in the United States. I think we're one of them. We have, you know, we're not as big as some schools, but I think, you know, we serve the state of Alaska. And I think we serve it well. It's about the right size, I think, for the state of Alaska.
Well, growing up in Alaska, I was always told that Alaska pilots are the best because they have so many different sets of circumstances to deal with, weather, distances, lack of landmarks, unexpected areas where they might have to land. And do you agree with that? Is this a particularly challenging place, and do Alaska pilots get extra expertise because of that?
It is a challenging place to fly due to the lack of infrastructure. It's a long way between, you know, reporting points, if you will, airports. We don't have much radar coverage up here, below 10,000 feet, very little radar coverage, and very few weather reporting points. And so there's an awful lot left to the pilot's judgment and experience. Whereas in the lower 48, generally it's not so far to get to an emergency airfield to land, or if the weather starts closing in. If you're an instrument rated pilot, you can get an instrument clearance or whatever. But around here, in a lot of places, you're just out of luck if you fly yourself into a tight spot.
Do you have ways of preparing folks for that?
Well, most of the training we do of our students, unlike what Chris and Bob were just talking about, it's on paved runways. We're teaching them basics. We're teaching them how to fly instruments. We're teaching them laws and regulations that are applicable to commercial operations. So we in the school are not taking our students out and doing bush flying. Mm-hmm. We do have some expertise there that Bob took, extensive experience, but that's not what we're about. We're about preparing people to make their living flying airplanes. For the most part, they're going to be doing that in a highly regulated, disciplined environment. And so there's not as much free play in commercial aviation as there is in private recreational aviation.
Yeah. So you're saying when parents take their hard-earned money and send their kids to college, they want them to actually do something with their aviation degree, not go out and land on river bars and have fun?
And that's our hope, too. And we encourage them to explore those opportunities, but in somebody else's airplane.
Right. So, Chris, here's a question for you. You've been flying for 34 years, mostly just to have fun. Like, what's the most fun or craziest or most interesting thing that you've done with your plane?
Well, by far and away, it's ski flying in the winter. And the ability to swap the wheels out, put skis on, depart the frozen surface of Lake Hood that was, just months before supporting float planes. And all of a sudden, you're in the mountains, and you see a high spot, a flat spot, and all of a sudden, you decide you want to land there. And, the incredible views. Amazing contrast on those cold, cold days where it's nothing but beautiful snow and blue sky. So, being able to land up high, my highest landing this winter was 9,400 feet out flying with a buddy of mine, and we decided we were going to land. And once we took off, the earth fell away beneath us, a glacier spilling down the mountains into Prince William Sound. And so ski flying by far and away is my favorite.
What is that... Does the ski have more resistance than wheels, so you have to have a little more distance, or how does that work? I've always wondered about that, knowing like how much room you need to take off, that would be a big concern.
It really depends. There's variabilities there, what type of snow it is, how deep it is, if it's hard packed, if it's wind blown. So there's days when the plane is supported by a hard packed, wind blown snow surface, and you can get off in no time. And other times where you really plan to land on a downhill slope, so you have the benefit of that assist from gravity in order to get off. So you really, it's a judgment call, what type of conditions you're in. You really have to pay attention, and deep snow, you can get an airplane stuck pretty easy, and you have to pull the snowshoes out and pack out a runway, and it might take you many more hours than you expect if you misjudge. So
Interesting. So you try to make your own runway. I mean, at some point you might have to do what? Call for a helicopter to rescue you if you totally mess up? Is that too embarrassing to contemplate?
It's much too embarrassing to contemplate, and it has happened to some people I know. But, oftentimes on a deep snow day, you'll drag the skis along the surface for a particular distance, and you'll come back and you'll drag an even further distance and maybe do this two or three times to pack your own runway and then land within that. So you're often prepping your own takeoff surface before you even land.
Mm-hmm. But Charles, ski planes don't have brakes. So in fact, I was flying with Chris this winter. I just learned how to fly a ski plane this winter and paid the price for that on a couple occasions. But we were landing up in the deep snow, probably about 6,000-7,000 feet up in the Harding Ice Field. And then we decided to go land on the beach down in Iolic Bay. And this was the first time I had landed on kind of crust. And you just don't stop. You hit your brakes, but there are no brakes. I mean, your wheels are on top of your skis, There are no brakes. And I kept on sliding, and it turned out to be fine. But you can slide a long way on skis.
We saw Bob come, and we saw Bob go, and it's like, there he is. There he goes.
So, so it sounds like you guys will fly just to get a group of buddies together to go flying?
It's always safer to fly with more than one person, particularly ski plane flying. It's so easy to get stuck.
But here's the thing. When I'm out with these guys, I feel like I'm 12 years old, and I've called my buddies up to say, hey, let's get on our mountain bikes and go down the trail. It's exactly that feeling. You've got that camaraderie with your buddies. You're hopping in the planes. There's three or four planes going together. And we're all experiencing this amazing beauty and this unique ability to fly to these places. And so I'm a kid again when I'm up there.
Oh, yeah, that sounds great.
And we put pictures on our Facebook pages, and people look at these pictures, and they just can't imagine.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we've got some pictures on our site at alaskapublic.org. Thanks for reminding me that, Bob. And we've got a video from Bob and some pictures that Chris took. It sounds like, Chris, you're thinking about doing some kind of publication with all the photos you've taken. I suppose you must get quite a backlog of pictures that you take.
You know, I've got some that are favorites now, and enough friends are asking and asking me to do a book. And, you know, Bob and I talked about, you know, what's so interesting about this? But, you know, it's things that most people have never seen, will never see. It's a perspective. You land on a sandbar, you take off, and you drop your wing and look down, and your buddy's landing on that same sandbar. So it's too compelling not to have a camera and preserve those memories and those scenes.
Yeah. Well, I got so into the conversation, I forgot to remind people that it's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth. We're talking about flying for fun, weekend pilots, recreational aviation in Alaska. Certainly, I've always dreamed about doing it myself. I've been on enough small planes going out to the bush and watched the countryside go by. I thought about, wow, how cool would it be? Three guests in the studio: Bob Kaufman, who's a pilot, has been for about 5 years. Chris Hodel has been one for basically his entire life. And Rocky Capozzi, who's a former fighter pilot and is now director of the UAA Aviation Center, teaching young people to be pilots. Bob, I wanted to ask you the same question I asked Chris. I know you do a lot of outdoor adventures. Is that sort of the direction you're going with flying? And is that what you thought you'd be doing, is like get out to do a river trip? And is that how it's ending up to be?
Well, I used to do lots of hiking trips and lots of river trips. It's a lot of work. You know, you prepare, you pack, you have to plan well in advance. The biggest thrill for me is that I can go to places in an afternoon that used to take me weeks to get to. Or, you know, if it's a float trip, it might take you 5 days to get to a place, you can just go land there. So just the idea that this beautiful wilderness that I used to work so hard to get to, that I can go there in an afternoon is thrilling.
Mm-hmm. So any bests that you want to share with us?
I've had so many great days. I mean, last summer, a friend of mine showed me this ridge, this really high ridge that we landed on overlooking on the west side of the inlet. It was beautiful. I did a plane camping trip last year for 3 days where I landed out on the shores of the lakes in Lake Clark National Park, and it was blue bird days. So it's beautiful because you're on the ground in these incredibly remote places, and then when you're in the air, you have, you know, this gorgeous view that you just don't get when you're hiking.
Mm-hmm. So I know you have young kids. Are you flying them around, and what do they think about it?
Well, I think they like it. It was funny. 2 days ago, I wanted to go out and get some hooligan on the Susitna River. So I asked my daughter, Alana, if she wanted to come. She said, no, she doesn't like small planes. She gets sick in small planes, which is obviously really upsetting because I'd love to do this. Well, then yesterday, we were at a party, at the Rust's party, and they were offering rides in their planes, and Alana was the first person to get in line.
Maybe she meant she gets sick in your plane.
Yeah. She's too kind.
Well, maybe that's a good segue to a topic we were talking about earlier, is like, the safety of the pilot surely has something to do with their expertise and with their experience. And Rocky, you know, I feel safer, honestly, with a professional pilot who I know is flying all day long than somebody who I don't know how often they fly. Maybe it's just a few weekends of summer or something, they get rusty. I mean, is that something that you observe, that you have to keep up a certain level of activity as a pilot in order to be a good pilot?
Sure, absolutely. You know, one of the biggest causes of accidents, honestly, is lack of proficiency. And it's, you know, it gets tough for a private pilot that, you know, is paying for everything himself. And, you know, we get some stretches of weather here in Alaska where, in the winter, where you're just not going to fly for maybe 3-4 weeks or more. So proficiency definitely is important. And there's a difference between being current, legally current, according to regulations, and being proficient. There's a big difference.
Mm-hmm. So how often should somebody be flying in order to say that, keeping their, you know, and still say they're a pilot, as to when somebody at some point says,
big opinion question, because it really depends on what you're flying, what your experience base is, You know, there's no straightforward answer, and I think you guys would agree with me mm-hmm. that there's a big difference depending on what you're doing, where you're going. You know, if you're going to go land on a glacier at 9,000 feet, you better be on your game. Mm-hmm. If you're landing on a 10,000 foot runway on a Bluebird day, yeah. That's sure. that's pretty non-challenging.
Yeah, I agree completely. And you know, there's times when you feel spot on, you've had several hours under your belt of this kind of flying, and you feel like you're right and ready to do certain things. There's other days where it's, you know what, it's just not worth it unless you really feel on your game, particularly bush landings. But you know, the technical element, the skill element aside, I think overall the most important element is judgment. And, you know, lots of people can control an aircraft and learn to control an aircraft, but to determine where am I going to go, when am I going to go, am I right and ready to do this on this particular day, have I judged the weather correctly? So by far and away, I think judgment is the real factor that keeps a good pilot alive. So
yeah, I'd agree with you, and that's true for boating, and it's true for a lot of outdoor activities is knowing where that line is, where you should just not do it, or where it's okay. And in fact, sometimes experience works against you there, because you think, well, the waves look pretty rough, but I've made it through this before, right? Well, maybe you only made it through it before, you know, on a, you know, a good chance, and maybe this is a time when you're not gonna. So I don't know, Bob, what do you think? How do you evaluate the risks when you're flying? And when you're first, I'm actually thinking about like your first year, when you're just doing it on your own and just starting, that must be a little bit scary.
Yeah, no, it's definitely scary. You're cautious. Racky could tell us, but I think the statistics are people that have the most problem are people that get to a threshold where they've got some basic skills, but have a lot more confidence than skills. Mm-hmm. Like, I think you're at risk at 200 hours. I think you're at risk at 600 hours again, because you feel like you're really good and you let your caution down. But I don't know. The challenging thing about aviation is, you know, you learn anything by making mistakes, and having close calls are just really dangerous when you have mistakes flying. So that's the hard thing. I've learned a lot from the mistakes I've made, but they also scare me.
Mm-hmm. You want to give an example? I mean, I don't...
Well, I was landing out in Prince William Sound with a friend last summer, and half my wheel was off the edge of a ridge. When I got out and looked, I'm like, oh my God, I just about flipped off the side of this. It was kind of a glacier ridge, and I knew I was close. I didn't know I was that close.
Uh-huh. So
it's a good thing you got out on the right side of the airplane.
Yeah, that's right. So next time it would just be scope it out a little bit better?
I have decided I'm going to be more picky about my landing situations. And then secondly, in that case, it was a narrow ridge. I didn't have a lot to play with. I actually and I couldn't see. You can't see what's underneath you when you're landing, so you're just going in on the line that you think is the right line. Probably in a case like that, until I have more experience, I just wouldn't land there.
Mm-hmm. Chris, any thoughts on that?
I've been fortunate not to have any incidents, and I grew up flying with my father, who flew for over 60 years up here, and you know, and he taught me the skill of evaluating and the importance of judgment. So I've been very lucky. I've not had any incidences or close calls in all those years.
Yeah. So Rocky, you must have an enormous number of hours in the air.
Well, not that many.
Really? Give us a number.
4,000 or so, but you know, they all came an hour at a time.
It seems like a lot. I mean, how do you weigh in on this this thing about how you get to be a better pilot? I mean, what's the...
Well, they've talked about judgment and spot on. I agree with that 100%. Now, how do you develop judgment? I think there is an educational component there. In addition to developing it in the air, which is, of course, very important, I think if you spend a lot of time analyzing accidents, I mean, my whole life, from the time I was a lieutenant until today, every time I can, I pick up an accident report and I read it and I analyze, you know, what went wrong. By doing that, you kind of keep your thought processes about risk management tuned up, so to speak, so you don't blunder into something, because you think about it on a periodic basis. You're always, you know, trying to figure out how other people erred, and hopefully that when your turn comes, you go, oh, I've seen that trap before.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
Yeah, I'm with Rocky on that. I read quite a few of them, and and try to evaluate exactly what went wrong and remind yourself that, you know, this thing, there's a reason it flies and there's a reason it's going to stop flying. And, you know, so it's...
Yeah. And, you know, and there's variables. There's not that many variables in flying, but they interact with each other. And so you can think this situation is similar to another situation, but just a few differences in where the wind's coming from or how strong the wind is coming from. Just a few differences in, you know, temperature and things like that can make a huge difference on you know, the aerodynamics.
Yeah, yeah, fascinating. Well, we've got a lot more to talk about in the second half of the show. It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Woolforth. My guest, you just heard Bob Kaufman, who's a pilot of relatively recent vintage. Chris Hodel has been a pilot all his life, and Rocky Capozzi, who's the director of the UAA Aviation Technology Center. We're going to be back in the second half to talk more about weekend pilots, recreational flying. We've got a question coming in from a listener on Facebook. Lots more to talk about, but right now it's time for the Outdoor Explorer calendar. The Alaska 4x4 meet and greet is this Saturday, June 15th at 10 a.m. in Wasilla at the Museum of Alaska Transportation and Industry. This annual event, hosting over 200 off-road enthusiasts, is an opportunity to unify the off-road community, promote off-road safety, and improve the accessibility of trails in Alaska. For more info on the Alaska 4x4 meet and greet and upcoming activities, plan for Father's Day weekend. Perfect time for that, huh? Search Alaska 4x4 meet and greet on Facebook. Late registration for the Mayor's Marathon closes on Wednesday, June 19th. The 40th annual marathon, half marathon, relay, or 4-mile race will take place in Anchorage on Saturday, June 22nd. To sign up before late registration closes on Wednesday, go to mayorsmarathon.com. If my legs hold together, I'll see you out there at the half marathon. A 3-day workshop on early edible and medicinal plants will be held in Homer at the Anamkara headquarters, June 21 to 23. Identify plants available in early summer and learn about their edible, nutritional, and medicinal value. Craft oils and tinctures. Then cook a wild-crafted meal to share. For more info, go to nancylee-evans.com. nancylee-evans.com. All right, so you can find all those things easily enough. We have links to them on alaskapublic.org. And all the other stuff about our show is there, too. Just click on today's show. To post your event on alaskapublic.org, just go to community calendar, and you can tell us all about it. So finally, the Trail of Blue Ice Walk, starting from the Baggage Box Visitor Center in Portage, is this Saturday, June 15th. And to tell us more about the scenic walk, we have with us by phone Clyde Falk of the Anchorage Volksport Club. Hi, Clyde. Thanks for being with us.
Hi, Charles. Great to be talking to you.
Yeah, so the Volksport Club, I guess, is something you picked up when you were in Germany, the idea of just getting together with folks and going for a hike.
Yes, that's what our Volksport is about over there. It's more of a social event than it is here, but it's all about fun, fitness, and friendship.
Uh-huh, and you just invite just a general public to come out for a hike and just meet each other and just enjoy the day together?
Yes, it's a free walk. Usually we have offer a 10-kilometer, which is 6.2 miles, and sometimes we offer 5K, which we don't on this case because it's Trail of Blue Ice is basically an out-and-back event out on the Trail of Blue Ice in Portage, so we just offer the 10K there, but yes.
All right, and so people should just show up at the trailhead. What time do they meet?
Okay, it is what we call the start hall is at the Baggage Bogs Visitor Center. They're in Portage, and they can show up anytime between 10 a.m. and 1 p.m., and we ask for them to finish the walk by 4 p.m.
Okay, and so folks will just be kind of socializing and taking the hike, and do you invite people to get involved in the club, and do you do sort of this on a regular basis?
I sure do. Anchorage World Sports Club has a membership. We have about 44 members at this time. and we're open to it. The walk is free, and we have, except those that like to brag a little bit and have record books, we have two books that are called the event book and the record kilometer book, and we record the number of kilometers we walk. In this case, it'd be at a 10-kilometer walk. And when we get our books to a mile post point, well, we send it into our headquarters in Texas, and they record that, and they send back a patch and a pin and a certificate to keep you interested in getting more of them.
Uh-huh. Neat. And I guess this is something that's being done all over the world, lots of different clubs. What is it that particularly attracted you to it or made you want to start a club here in Anchorage?
Because of the things that you mentioned, it's the exercise that really is the top thing. Most people can get out and walk. It's not a stressful. We're not in great physical shape. It's non-competitive, so you don't have to compete against anybody except like myself. It might be my wife that we're out there, but you meet your friends there, and you can walk with your family, bring your pet along, and have an enjoyable time. You get to see so many different things when you're looking at it from the ground, and we have these events in the different locations all over the world so that you can see what the locals want you to see.
Oh, I see. So do you get visitors from Europe or from other places who join your club events?
We sure do. It's a very active event over there. A lot of people participate in it. In mainly Germany, you get a lot more Germans than anybody, because obviously with the name Bull Sports, which is a people sports, it started there, and they like to do it. And since we have these various programs, one of the programs which we have to get you interested in walking is you can walk in all 50 states, and they have a book for that so that you can put the stamp in that book, and then when you get through, you send it in, and you get a patch that says you walked in all 50 United States.
I see.
And the people from Europe, they still want to do that, you know. They want to get the patch from the United States and say they walked in it.
Oh, that's
in
neat.
All the 50 states, so.
So this is great. This is a great place to meet people and maybe meet people from overseas. Saturday, June 15th, 10 a.m. at the Begich Boggs Visitor Center. Thanks for being with us, Clyde Falk from the Anchorage Volk Sport Club.
Hey, you're welcome. Thanks for having me.
All right. Well, stay with us for the second half of the show. We'll be talking more about recreational aviation when Outdoor Explorer continues.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer from KSKA Anchorage. The program repeats tonight at 7 p.m. on FM 91.1. Connect with Outdoor Explorer anytime, download podcasts, and see what's coming up on future programs at alaskapublic.org.
We're back. It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolfworth, and we're talking about recreational flying. I have three guests in the studio today. Rocky Capozzi is the director of the UAA Aviation Technology Center. Chris Hodel, a pilot, has been all his life, and Bob Kaufman, a pilot who has learned to be one in the last, what, 5 or 6 years or so. And Bob, you have a video. What are we going to see in the video? Let me put it up.
Oh, so I on my 182, I hooked a really high-end production camera to the front wing strut and have taken some really beautiful forward-facing planet Earth-style aerials. I've got hours and hours of it. So I took maybe 90 seconds of some pretty nice footage and put it into a video. It's kind of, you know, what it looks like to fly around Alaska.
So did you cut together different? So it's all different places.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Cool.
We also have a section on the Alaska app, which is like 28 flyover videos under the video guide on the Alaska app, which are longer segments, maybe a minute or two. Some of them are sped up. Like there's one shot I took starting down at Portage, going all the way to Anchorage, which is 20 minutes of flying, and you can do it in 90 seconds in this video.
Oh, neat. Alaska app is your phone app that you do through your business.
iPhone mobile app, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So we had a question over Facebook, and you guys can all weigh in on this. Molly's asking for destination suggestions for the renter pilot. She says, my time is usually limited to 2.5 flight hours in paved strips. Love Kinnick Glacier, but would love to explore other areas close to Anchorage. Who wants to give some tips on places close to Anchorage for
it? It gets a little challenging with respect to that because rental companies have restrictions on where you can take their planes, and most of them demand a hard surface. So, a trip down to Seldovia, which I would recommend to anybody, may not be permitted in a rental school aircraft.
Because their runway isn't paved?
It's a dirt strip, and it's a little bit challenging of a runway, water on both ends, so it's a little bit like landing on an aircraft carrier, but it's one of my favorite places to go.
And why is it so fun to go down there? Just because in the evening go to eat out or something?
Yeah, you can walk into town from, land at the runway, mm-hmm. and it's a 10-minute walk into Seldovia, and a little tide pool cafe there is good mm-hmm. food, and it gets you into a little different environment.
Any ideas, Bob?
Well, if you're restricted to paved, flying up to Talkeetna is great because you can walk into town and get lunch. If you're not restricted to paved, going to Hope is great, going to Sheep Mountain Lodge is great, and walking over to their restaurant, going out to Squintna. There's a book in the lower 48, I think it's called The $100 Hamburger. It's about places you can go into your airplane and get lunch. And we were thinking about actually adding some of this content to our app, but I think a lot of these places are gravel. Other than Talkeetna, everything I just mentioned is gravel.
Mm-hmm. Now, Rocky, for your students, do you have restrictions on what they can do with the aircraft?
Absolutely. All of our operations are done on paved runways. And our students, we only use the aircraft for syllabus training. So we don't rent the airplanes to the students on the weekends. Once they've earned their private certificate, if they want to fly, on their own or take their mom or dad or friend out to fly, we encourage them to do that, but they'll go and rent their planes from other vendors on the field.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So, Rocky, you fly for fun as well. Do you have anywhere close to town if you just have limited time that you'd like to go to?
Like Bob said, I like to run up to Talkeetna for the $100 hamburger. I like to go down to, a week ago, I flew down to Homer and just took a cab out to the Spit, and mm-hmm. spent the afternoon and poked around.
Yeah, that sounds fun. It seems like is there enough time to sort of after work to get out and fly somewhere typically? I mean,
especially during summer.
Yep.
And I believe Land and Sea Aviation has one plane that you're allowed to land on gravel. I mean, mm-hmm. they'll tell you strip by strip where you can land.
I see. So, it gets us into the sort of the money issue, which has got to be a big one. Airplanes cost a lot of money. Renting them costs a lot of money. Getting trained costs a lot of money. Give us a sense.
Wrecking them costs even more.
Right.
Well, I'll tell you, in my profession, I'm an investment manager, but the one thing I do with respect to flying is I pay no attention to the money. If you think about it, you won't do it. It's not an inexpensive hobby. Fuel's over $5 a gallon, and my Super Cub, I burn almost 8 gallons per hour. But I literally don't let myself go there or else I couldn't justify the expense.
Mm-hmm. You can't completely. I remember when I got into flying, things that I would just never permit myself to spend money on, I'm starting to spend that amount of money. And then you feel guilty. You look at your wife hemming and hawing over, should I get this for $200? And it's like, yeah, I just spent that in, 4 hours of flying.
Right. What does it cost to buy a plane these days?
Boy, it really varies. A nice Super Cub, $85,000 to $140,000.
But that's a Super Cub. You can, when I was looking at planes, I was looking at 172s. I could have gotten in the air for $25,000 on a very safe plane.
Okay. What do you think, Rocky?
Yeah, they're talking about used airplanes here, mm-hmm. both.
Yes.
That same 172 out of the factory today cost you $330,000.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, most of your four-place single-engine planes that are in manufacture today are about $300,000. So the used plane market's huge. And just a few years ago, about the time you started flying, that was right after the 2008 economic mess. And so there were a lot of wonderful deals on used airplanes.
So what did it cost to rent a plane? I mean, just ballpark. You guys, you don't have to do that, so maybe you don't
like
know.
Like 80 or 90 bucks an hour?
Oh, no,
like
it's more than that. It's it's more like $150 to $200 an hour, depending on what airplane you're running.
Right, right. So we're, I mean, we're talking like, you know, for if you're going to have a fly for an afternoon, you better, and you don't have your own plane, you're probably going to be spending most of a grand.
Well, I'll tell you, you look around what Alaskans do, though, and you're going to put that money into a boat or a nice motorhome right. or something. So it's really a you know, a decision about what you want to spend your time and money on. And so for me, it's worth it. And I would tell any, you know, 15-year-old kid, guy or girl alike, go out there and earn your pilot's license, earn that skill, develop that confidence, take advantage of what Alaska has to offer. And, you know, I laugh about it now, but it was... babysitting money, paper route money, and working at Army Navy surplus when I was 14 years old that got me enough money to, you know, to study for my pilot's license.
Right. So, right. Well, that's the thing. Getting out into Alaska costs a lot of money, however you do it.
Let me clarify one thing. You could go flying for an afternoon for $225. You only pay for the time in the air. So if you flew out to Squintna, for example, it's maybe 35 minutes, you go walk into town, you spend the whole afternoon, you come back. So you've, you know, spent $225.
I got you. So what about these home-built planes or kit planes that I'm hearing about? Are those safe? Are those, is that something people are doing a lot more these days than they used to? Rocky?
I think they're safe.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if they're built right, they're safe. They have a category of aircraft now called light sport airplanes. And the idea there was to actually have an entry-level airplane that people could afford to buy and would be much cheaper to fly because they have smaller engines. They weigh less. So instead of a $300,000 airplane, you're looking at something more like $120,000 buying a brand new airplane with, you know, its best features, you know, all the upgrades or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But so, yeah, I mean, they're safe. Now, if you're going to build one yourself, you really need to have some guidance. I mean, it's not like buying a model airplane in the store.
Right.
it's fairly complex. So
high stakes, yeah. So, I can't imagine building, something like that. It would be...
So, you know, on the cost of airplanes, I'm afraid we're sending the wrong impression. Uh-huh. There are a lot of people in Alaska who have had, you know, limited salary through the years that haven't owned an airplane, that fly a lot. It's important to them. And I think it's dangerous to give the impression that recreational flying is a rich man's province. It may be when it comes to private jets in the lower 48. It isn't when you live in the western states. It isn't when you live in Alaska. I know guys who, you know, were school teachers their whole life. They fly. I mean, they're careful. They don't waste gas.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, in Alaska, you know, a lot of people fly out of necessity, and it's not the province of people with a lot of money. And in fact, you know, people with a lot of money tend to be dangerous, right? They don't have as much time to work on their flying skills.
Whoa. I don't know about that one, but
come on, there's a very serious, okay, I've seen some nice YouTube videos in the past couple of years who've crashed multi-$100,000 airplanes with their families in them. You know, doctors and people like that who, have more money than time.
Yeah.
Well, and certainly, again, it goes back to what Rocky was saying earlier about that skill set and, you know, not just being current, but being proficient. You know, and Bob's point is true. You know, I've seen a lot of aircraft out there. They may not be pretty birds, but, you know, $40,000-$50,000 and you're into a very functional aircraft that can get you out to an awful lot of fun. So, you know, it's,
which is what you'd pay for a really nice like 24-foot motorboat with an outboard on it.
Sure.
Or go buy a new SUV or even a used SUV for $40,000.
Right. Yeah, my plane's 50 years old.
Yeah,
well, that's the thing about planes; they never seem to wear out, right?
You can it's always they keep replacing them a piece at a time.
Right,
right. They are, and that's you know your one of your most important investments is your mechanic. You know, finding a good mechanic and maintaining your aircraft to a very high standard, and that's That's the best insurance of all, that's going to remain airworthy and serve mm-hmm. you well.
Well, we should talk about airplanes, and I imagine you guys are like people with boats, that you don't mind it when people ask you about your airplane. So we'll do that in just a minute. It's Outdoor Explorer. My name is Charles Wolforth. Our topic today is recreational aviation. In the studio with me, Chris Hodel, a pilot, Rocky Capozzi, also a pilot, also happens to be director of the UAA Aviation Technology Center, and Bob Kaufman, also a pilot. Who wants to go first telling me about your plane and what's good about it? Chris, you're on.
All right, I'm on. Well, the current airplane is a Super Cub. I've only owned it for 4 years now. I previously flew a Cessna 206 and had a yen for a different kind of flying. So I was very fortunate. My mechanic called me up, knew this airplane, and said...
So 206 would be like a 4 or 5 passenger.
A 6 passenger. It's a large, it's like a Chevy Suburban with wings.
Right.
It's a big, heavy hauler. It's a wonderful airplane, good cross-country aircraft. But
and the Super Cub is a lot smaller, and you can land in smaller spots.
I tell people the Super Cub is like a Jeep. You know, it's just top down, you know, big tires, go wherever you want to go. And so it's slow, but it's designed to be... operated in you know, remote environments, unimproved, you know, strips. So
slow meaning
you know, it's my max speed is 95 miles an hour cruise speed in this thing, and the slowest 38 miles an hour is about
wow.
slow as I'm comfortable in this aircraft. But my mechanic knew of this plane, told me it was for sale, and he said you better be here in a half an hour to buy it, and that's about all it took me to get over there and pick it up, because it was rebuilt by a guy by the name of Rod Hsu here in Anchorage, who's one of the top builders. And so I knew that it had been gone through and completely rebuilt in 2000. So it was basically a new airplane.
What makes it so capable in the short runways? Is it big wings or a lot of power in the engine? Or
it's a little bit of both, but it's actually the design of the wing, the airfoil. So it's designed to, you know, to provide a, you know, significant lift at slow speeds. It has extended flaps on it so that I can... you know, put out the drag when I need to, and create lift when you want to. So it's just the specific design of this aircraft is great for low and slow.
Mm-hmm.
And it'll carry a heck of a load too. I mean, you can put a moose in the back and take off with a guy my size. I'm a 6.5 foot tall guy, and it'll get up and go.
So. All right. So Rocky, your turn. Tell us about your plane.
Mine's pretty pedestrian compared to the two planes these fellows have. It's a Cessna 172. I think it's an iconic airplane. Everybody sort of visualizes that when they think of a single engine airplane. And I'm not outfitted for you know, bush flying. I don't have Tundra tires on my airplane. Yeah, neat features. It's got a different engine in it. It's got a Franklin 220, so I have quite a bit of horsepower for that airplane, which means I can get off the ground pretty quickly and climb pretty steeply. So that's mm-hmm. a good feature.
And how many the four-seater?
It's, but you know, technically it's a four-seater. One of the things a lot of people do is they go, oh, there's four seats. I think I can put four people in there, and that's one of those errors of logic. Because they're overloading the airplane. And so I never fly it with four adults in there. Three adults is sort of my cutoff, because I like to carry some survival gear in the back of the airplane, mm-hmm. always.
Yeah.
So, and, you know, other neat features, it's got an IFR-certified GPS unit in it and a moving map display. So that's
nice.
That's good to have for situational awareness. You don't have to spend quite as much time, you know, worrying about following your map as you fly along.
Yeah. I've been in some scary flights when people seem to be lost and they're trying to look at the map surreptitiously and like figure out where they are. And I'm sitting there thinking, I don't think he knows where he is.
So I always like to hand the map to my passenger and say, could you find out where we are?
Yeah.
we're somewhere in this part of the map. Would you look out the window and try to figure out where that is?
You brought up a great issue, though, in terms of overloading. I think that's maybe one of the biggest causes of crashes in Alaska, is that too much moose meat or too many bricks or whatever it is put on the plane. And it's load and balance, right?
So absolutely, load and balance.
So that's something that a pilot needs to learn and be really aware of. And it seems like it's something passengers should be aware of, just in terms of looking over the shoulder. Yes?
Yeah, the responsibility is with the pilot, you know, certainly you have cases where people have overloaded their aircraft or load shifting issues. But like Rocky mentioned, the 172 being a four seats, but really 2 to 3 people. The 206 was the same way. Typically, I operate it with just 4 seats, and then you have room for gear, your survival gear, which is always in the plane by Alaska state law, by the way. You know, again, it's understanding your aircraft. There are weight and balance calculations that you are required to do to make sure you're within a specific envelope of performance of that aircraft.
Mm-hmm, so. Mm-hmm. Wasn't there some kind of campaign that was done telling folks, you know, if you're going to get on a plane, if you don't feel comfortable, say something?
It was the Medallion Foundation, right. And mm-hmm. They're trying to encourage passengers to, if they chose to do so, you know, ask the pilot if there are, you know, is the weight and balance been done? Are we in, mm-hmm. you know, just sort of nudge the process along.
Uh-huh. So, Bob, tell us about your plane.
So I'll tell you something. One of the more difficult purchases I ever made was my first airplane. Because if you go ask pilots what the best airplane is, how could it be that they are the genius and everybody else who bought a different plane is a complete idiot?
Right.
and what it boils down to is different planes for different missions. Uh-huh. So the Super Cub, you know, I have a plane, it's a Husky, it's like that. It's great for short takeoff and landing. If I want to go land in the mountains, if I want to go land on a river bar, it's great. It's terrible for cruise speed, right?
Slow,
yeah. So it takes a long time to get anywhere. You know, so you're always making the trade-off between that, between how much, you know, cargo carrying capacity does it have. I have a friend, no matter where I go, Wynn Faulkner, he will unload everything from his turn and put it on the ground and say, look how much stuff my plane carries. So it's a great plane for that. But, you know, it's all a series of trade-offs. So I think when you're buying an airplane, you have to really figure out what your primary mission is. And the truth is, this is why a lot of people have, you know, if they can afford it, have two planes, because, you know, I've got a plane that carries one person. I've got 3 kids. I like to do things with all my kids. I can only carry one kid. Now it's hard
that's
to get
a Husky
one,
only.
Yeah, okay. One other person. It's a two. Mm-hmm. It's a 2-seater. So that's why there's so many different models of airplanes out there, because people are trying to do very different missions.
Mm-hmm. And that's it. I went through this with Bob when he was looking to buy his plane, and it really came down to what's your mission and what do you do the most of. And particularly, you know, I found that it's what do your friends do the most of. If you're going to fly with people and you're in a 185 and they're all in Super Cubs, you may not be able to join up and do the same thing. So, knowing what your mission is and what you're going to do most of, that helps you to determine the plane that's right for you.
Yeah. And friends is a key thing. I have learned so much by flying with friends. I've taken classes. I read this magazine that comes to me. This is really kind of an apprenticeship business if you want to be good. You got to fly with people who you learn from. I think that's really the most important decision. And then they call you, they're going flying, they have a great idea, they encourage you. That's really what broadens your horizons.
Yeah, I didn't realize the social aspect of it. Wynn, who you guys are talking about, I happen to know his cabin is near my cabin. I drive 5 hours and I get on the boat and go an hour. It takes me a day to get there. He just jumps in the plane. Boom, he's there at the end of work. You know?
Exactly.
But he was also telling me about going out and meeting friends for the Iditarod, flying out to some place, camp along the way, and watching the dogs go by and having a bonfire. It sounds fabulous.
Wynn put in a great strip up there, and this is up on the Yetna River. And he and some friends had gone in with snow machines and packed out a safe runway on the river ice. And I think... we all descended in on the place, and within minutes there were 15 airplanes there. And at the most, I think we've had 25 fixed wing and 3 helicopters, and a big bonfire, tents, and you know, good food and great friends.
Oh, that really does sound like fun. Yeah, and an exclusive party. You have to have your own plane to get there, right?
What's interesting is that you will see, if you fly out on the Iditarod day, that you'll have camp after camp. So there may be 8 or 10 different groups. And so you know there's a group of people you may never have met having the exact same kind of fun. And you take a little, you know, pleasure in the fact that they're enjoying it as well.
Mm-hmm. I'll tell you what's really fun. You listen in on different frequencies when you're flying, and these are people that are, you know, miles apart having these conversations in the air. It's really fascinating when you think about it. Mm-hmm. You know, here you are, kind of just these little birds up in the sky, but having a conversation like somebody sitting across from the table from you.
Yeah, it sounds like planes really coming into their own for Iditarod. That sounds like a really good time to be out there. Yeah. So, Rocky, a few years ago, there was a serious problem with general aviation because of insurance, and the manufacturers stopped making planes, and there was Merrill Field was seeing a big reduction in number of planes operations. It seems like it's come back a little bit. What's your perception of the trend in terms of what's happening?
Well, new airplane sales have been flat here for 4 or 5 years, but to the point you made earlier, of course, they are manufacturing again, and what happened was there was a change in the law that deals with liability, and so it became feasible for the manufacturers to get back in the business. I think if you talk to the Merrill Field Tower folks, they will tell you that business is, it's about flat, you know, I go to these meetings and they actually tell you the number of operations they've had in the last 12 months. But I want to say they're in an operation, a technical term for them, all it really means is a takeoff or landing. I want to say they're around 180,000 or something like that. So it's a, in the world of general aviation airports, it's a pretty busy airport. There aren't many general aviation airports that have more business than that. Mm-hmm. But it's not as high as it was 15 years ago. I think there were around 300,000 operations.
Mm-hmm. What's your feel, Chris? You've been at this a long time. More people flying now or less?
No, definitely less and cost. Fewer operations. Mm-hmm. And I think cost is a big one. It's a big element of it. When I was a kid flying, Merrill Field is one of the busiest airports in the nation. Mm-hmm. I remember, and probably Rocky might have been one of these guys, but I remember flying out one day and there was a left Merrill Field, and there was a transport aircraft, a couple of F-4 Phantoms, and me and a little 172 all sharing the same airspace. And you'd enter the pattern at Merrill, and there'd be five aircraft in the pattern with you of various size and speed. So it's definitely down.
Yeah. And it's actually a real problem nationally. They're closing general aviation airports. Mm-hmm. And it's not just fun. I mean, it teaches you discipline. You learn a lot when you learn to fly.
It's great. And it's such an inherent part of Alaska. It really is. It is the Alaskan thing, in my opinion. It's really, all my life it's been that way. Hey, this has been a really fun conversation. It went by fast for me. I want to thank Bob Kaufman and Chris Hodel, who are both recreational pilots and came in on a beautiful day to talk to us rather than flying, and Rocky Capozzi, who's also a pilot and is the director of the UAA Aviation Center. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Next week's show is about glacier travel. We've got guests lined up to talk about how to do it, how to take pictures of it, and the science behind the shapes and hazards of glaciers. We'd love to hear from you, too. If you have questions you'd like me to address, go to our Outdoor Explorer Facebook page. We'll also be interested in your feedback on today's show and ideas for future shows and guests. The Glacier Show actually came about because of a listener suggestion we received online. Other shows we have planned that you can help us build: on June 27th, Mount Marathon; July 4th, we take the day off; and July 11th, the Fireweed 500 bike race. We can use your help, so please let us know on Facebook or alaskapublic.org if you have ideas for those shows. That's all for today on Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolfort. Our producer is Kristen Speck. Thanks for joining us, and I'll see you outside.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. Theme music is by Portugal the Man. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect the station or its underwriters. You can find Outdoor Explorer on Facebook and iTunes. To see what's coming up on Outdoor Explorer and add your voice to the conversation, go to alaskapublic.org.